This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tim Page, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic who found out in middle age that he had the autistic disorder Asperger syndrome. That helped explain the lifelong unease he experienced and why his pervasive childhood memory was an excruciating awareness of his own strangeness. Page has written a new memoir called Parallel Play, Life as an Outsider. It's about how his condition affected his life and his relationship with music. Page won the Pulitzer in 1997 for his work as chief classical music critic at the Washington Post. That was 3 years before his diagnosis. Before joining the Post, he was a music critic at the New York Times and Newsday. He's now a professor of journalism and music at the University of Southern California. Tim Page, welcome to Fresh Air. What did they tell you when they gave you the diagnosis of Asperger's? What did they tell you that meant?
Well, I'm now allowed by my middle son to tell the circumstances where I was diagnosed. We had taken my son Robbie in because he was having some social difficulties. And that's when he was diagnosed, and he has just given me permission to talk about this because he's 19. That was when I was diagnosed. I'd never heard of it. It turns out it's terribly hereditary. It turns out that a good amount of adults are actually diagnosed when their children are diagnosed. And my own guess is that my father had it too. So the doctor just gave a long and thoughtful explanation of the condition and then diagnosed my son and then said, you have it too. And so I went out and I went to see my own doctor and read up on it, and I was pretty sure that I had it as well.
What year and how old were you when you were diagnosed with Asperger's?
I was 45 years old, and it was in the fall of 2000. So it was either, I believe I was then still 45, but I turned 46 that fall. I'll give you a good description from David Mamet, who wrote in his book Bambi versus Godzilla, about Asperger's syndrome. And he wrote that it's not impossible that it helped make the movies. The symptoms of this developmental disorder include early precocity, a great ability to maintain masses of information, a lack of ability to mix with groups in age-appropriate ways, ignorance of or indifference to social norms, high intelligence and difficulty with transition, married to a preternatural ability to concentrate on the minutiae of the task at hand. I had all of that. I continue to have all of that. I can remember all sorts of trivia, but I don't notice what somebody has on. I neglect my, you know, my shirt tails and I guess it's sort of like your absent-minded professor times five, if that makes any sense. And it's somewhere, at least most experts agree, it's somewhere along the autistic spectrum, which means somewhere in the 0 to 100 of, you know, 0 having no autistic traits and 100 being completely isolated. I'm somewhere in the middle.
Usually when you get a diagnosis, the goal is to get some kind of medication or therapy to help fix it. With what you have, which is, you know, Asperger's, is there something you're trying to fix, or is the diagnosis just helping you define certain behavior patterns and help you figure out who you are and how to make the most of who you are?
I would say that the diagnosis helped me realize that there were certain things that were part of my nature and that were pretty much fixed, that were not very changeable, much as I would like them to be changeable. And it helped me avoid things, I would say, for the most part. But I was already on all sorts of palliative things for people with Asperger's. I mean, I've had my own little prescription for Valium since I was 15, and I've been on antidepressants, and I've been on, you know, I meditate. I do everything I can to sort of get through a day. And most days I get through pretty well. And I know when I need to just escape and get rid of whatever overstimulation I'm feeling and sort of calm myself. And that's the big struggle for me during the day, and, you know, before the one at night, which is getting to sleep one way or another. I'd like to think that there's a utopia someplace where kids who are 2 and 3, it's explained to them gently what they have, and they're given some therapy that helps them to deal with parents, teachers, peers. And maybe the depression and the anxiety will go away. But certainly depression and anxiety were concomitant states that I've had since I came to consciousness.
You write, from early childhood, my memory was so acute and my wit so bleak that I was described as a genius. I wrapped myself in this mantle as poetic justification for behavior that might otherwise have been judged unhinged. Like what? What kind of license did your eccentricities give you?
Well, I don't think they really gave me a whole lot of license, but the school kind of had to put up with me, and it was a small town, so they promoted me to the next grade. I was either asleep looking out windows when the teacher was talking about something that I wasn't interested in, or I was acting out and making faces and, you know, answering with ridiculous questions or just basically showing my contempt for the class all through my childhood. And I couldn't get this out of my system. I was aggressive and I'd push people out on the playground. I mean, I wasn't really a bully because I was inept as an athlete. But I got D's and F's and an occasional C. I was thrilled when I got a B. It was really one of those things where I simply couldn't concentrate except on the stuff that I could concentrate on very well. And back then, the idea that somebody could be articulate and could actually still have an autistic disorder, they didn't compute. The idea of somebody who was autistic was somebody who rarely spoke and maybe banged his head. And I was sort of doing my own version of head banging, although it was not quite in the same way. The thing that was really nice was some teachers, recognizing that I was overstimulated, would let me go to the nurse's office where I'd calm myself down. And the nicest teachers would actually let me stay in at recess, where I'd always get in trouble and get myself punched out or something. And I'd just stay in and I'd read through the World Book Encyclopedia and I basically memorized it. It was a strange brain, you know.
Looking back, how do you think Asperger syndrome affected your interest in music and how you listened to music when you were coming of age?
I have this theory that Asperger's syndrome has been hugely important for me with music because it was the first world that made any sense to me. I didn't really understand what was going on around me. I didn't understand what people really wanted me to do, what kind of expressions. I was a very lost little kid, but my mom had this record player, and she was kind enough to let me ruin her record collection by just playing records over and over and over again. And I'd memorize what all the music was. And it allowed me passage into a world where everything made sense and where I felt this profound sense of being at home in the world. And it was always very easy for me to talk about music. I mean, I couldn't identify chords or anything technical, but I could make at least enough sense out of it for me that it showed me that there was kind of another dimension out there, and I wanted to be in that dimension as much as I could because the real world didn't make any sense to me.
You write in your book that when you first heard Philip Glass and his pattern minimalist music, that you felt, I forget the words you exactly used, but you felt like you were listening to the inside of your very essence, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Describe what you felt when you first heard minimalist music.
Well, I'd heard a little bit of it beforehand because there were a couple of records that came out in the late 60s, Terry Riley, and Steve Reich did some fairly early recordings. So I knew a little bit about it. But the 1976 was a huge year for me because there was the world premiere of Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. And then later in the year, the U.S. premiere of Einstein on the Beach by Philip Glass and Robert Wilson. And especially with Music for 18 Musicians, it had me so incredibly excited by all that was going on in the music that I went up to my room and I started writing what I consider my first more or less mature criticism.
We queued up, because you mentioned it in your book, we queued up Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. I want to play the first minute of it.
Okay.
And then I want you to talk about it and tell us if you remember what you wrote about it, because you say the first real serious piece of music criticism that you wrote was about this piece after you heard it. So let's give it a shot for a minute, and then we'll talk. The opening of Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. And
so wonderful.
Isn't it wonderful? Yeah, I know. So, Tim Page, what does that music do for you when you hear it?
Well, I thought I'd read you a little bit of what I wrote that night.
Oh, terrific.
In April of 1976, as a 21-year-old, having absolutely no idea that anybody would ever publish me. But I spent the whole night trying to describe that music in words. And I said, imagine concentrating on a challenging modern painting that becomes just a little bit different every time you shift your attention from one detail to another. Or trying to impose a frame on a running river, making it a finite, enclosed work of art, yet leaving its kinetic quality unsullied, leaving it flowing freely on all sides. And then I said, it has been done. Steve Reich has framed the river. And I still have that same sort of feeling for this music. I guess I would add now that it's music that's not so much about going places and arriving somewhere and big crises and climaxes as it is about the actual journey rather than arrival or leaving from someplace. You're just fascinated by what's going on at the moment, just surrendering yourself to speed and jostling and, you know, gorgeous sensations that that overwhelm you. And I love the sort of patterning of it all.
And, you know, the patterning is very repetition, but at the same time, it's constantly shifting in perceptible and almost imperceptible ways. Does that speak to you?
Very, very much. And that really is what I think my insides feel like. But it calls to mind this kind of ecstatic quality, which I've occasionally felt. One of my very few visual, ecstasies is watching clouds change slowly over the course of an afternoon. I love process. I love patterns. I love seeing things just change slightly, but also still catching you up in the whole process. And that's something that I remember from being very, very young. And I love the fact that there are some wonderful musicians who are exploring that now.
As a teenager, you tried LSD several times, and you say the trips were nightmarish. And
yep.
I'm wondering if you think your symptoms were magnified by the LSD and if that contributed to the bad trips.
Anything in the world that makes me more self-conscious is the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And LSD and marijuana, both of which I tried and tried and tried to like in my mid-teens, college campus and a lot of my friends doing them, were really sort of nightmarish for me. I had a great time on marijuana for a while, but it started to induce panic attacks, which continued. And I think they may have had something to do with the LSD that I took. All of this stuff I did before I ever, drank wine civilly. It was so much easier in those days, especially on a college campus, to find drugs than it was to, split a six-pack of beer. So I think probably my anxiety level was not going to be helped by these, you know, very much internalizing drugs. And with LSD, in one case, I just took such a huge dose that I just lost myself entirely. And it's, you know, I thought that taking LSD would be like swallowing a movie, and I'd just be watching it on a screen, and I'd see some nice things and some frightening things. But what happens, of course, is that your whole brain is so screwed up, and you're so lost by it that all that it did for me was just made me want to scream and run and escape from all this terror that was in my system, which I think is there pretty much to begin with, but certainly those kind of drugs make it much, much worse. And it's, you know, they've been something that I've avoided, you know, very strongly for, you know, 35 years.
I want to bring up something that I don't think you write about in the book. And this, this had a big impact on you professionally. And I think it's possible it relates to what we were talking about in terms of inappropriate behavior. That you.
I think I know where you're going.
You know where I'm driving. A couple of years ago, when you were a music critic at the Washington Post, you wrote a very inappropriate email to one of Marion Barry's aides, and you were on their like email list for their press releases and stuff, and you wanted to get off of it. And do you mind if I just quote the line that you wrote?
I don't love it, but I don't mind.
Okay. You demanded to be taken off the email list and wrote, "Must we hear about it every time this crack addict attempts to rehabilitate himself with some new and typically half-witted political grandstanding? I'd be grateful if you would take me off your mailing list. I cannot think of anything the useless Marion Barry could do that would interest me in the slightest, up to and including overdose." So you apologized for that.
I mean, I felt terrible that I'd done it, but there was a story behind that. I had asked to be taken off the email list before, and his flack had actually called me all sorts of four-letter words and said things about my mother and, you know, I mean, just was really impossible about it. And so this happened to come in on a very, very bad day. And I thought, well, they don't seem to take my word for it, so I'm going to zing it to them. I never expected they'd turn it into anything. But and, you know, if I were Marion Barry, I don't think I'd want everybody in the world to remember that I had been a crack addict or a crack user. But they seemed to want to turn it into something, and they seemed to want to blame the Washington Post for it. And they seemed to want to make me out as a racist. And I was very crude there, but I felt that it was, you know, something which I should apologize for. And I did. And the Post agreed with me, and the Post stood by me. And so, you know, he wanted to publicize it. He got his moment in the sun. And, you know, it was very embarrassing for me. I was miserable. I'd just been through a split up with somebody I love dearly, and I overreacted. I feel badly about it, but I still sometimes overreact to things.
You know, I've worn glasses since kindergarten, and you write in your book that you rarely wear your glasses now because they make you aware of too much.
Yeah, I know. I know.
It's an interesting choice.
It's a quirk, and I should be wearing them, but I don't drive. And I see well enough to read. And I found that when I started trying to adapt to glasses, two things happened. Number one, my ability to read without glasses seemed somewhat impacted. But number two, I all of a sudden felt that I was being intimate with everybody on the street. You know, I'd just look at somebody, I'd look at them looking back at me, and it began to feel very invasive and somewhat anxiety provoking. And so, since I don't drive, I haven't really had to wear glasses because I can see close up front. But I guess in general, I like the fact that I kind of put the world together by sensation and sound and, you know, patterns. And I find it strangely invasive to be out there. It's one of the reasons I don't drive, too. I don't want to compete with people. And I think if I could, I'd like to be invisible.
Tim Page, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The beloved children's book, Where the Wild Things Are, has been adapted into a movie directed by my guest, Spike Jones, who also directed Adaptation and Being John Malkovich. Jones co-wrote the screenplay with Dave Eggers. Where the Wild Things Are is an unlikely book for a film adaptation. It's a short book with fantastic illustrations. Some pages have no writing at all. Others have 1 to 3 lines. As Jones says, the book is almost like a poem. The story in the book is about a boy named Max who has been mischievous, so his mother sends him to his room without dinner. Alone in his room, he imagines his ceiling hung with vines and the walls becoming the world all around, with an ocean on which he sails to where the wild things are. The wild things are fantastic creatures. The film is not animated. The 10-feet-high wild things were created by Jim Henson's Creature Shop. The boy is played by Max Records. The wild things are voiced by James Gandolfini, Catherine O'Hara, Forrest Whitaker, and Paul Dano. Here's a scene with Max and Gandolfini.
This part of your kingdom's not so good.
Why?
Well, look, this used to be all rock, and now it's sand, and then one day it's going to be dust, and then the whole island will be dust, and then I don't even know what comes after dust.
Carol.
Mm-hmm?
Did you know the sun was going to die?
What? I never heard that. Oh, come on. That can't happen. I mean, you're the king. Look at me. I'm big. How could guys like us worry about a tiny little thing like the sun? Huh?
The idea that Spike Jones adapt Where the Wild Things Are was proposed by the author himself, Maurice Sendak. They've been friends for about 14 years since working together on another project. Jones declined several times before saying yes, and even when he agreed to do it, he was unsure how.
As I started to think about, you know, just what's in the book and thinking about expanding what's there and Max, you know, at this moment of Max acting wild and out of control and yelling at his mom and his mom yelling back at him and what that would really mean, just sort of going deeper into it and what would the moments in Max's life at home be about and what would be happening in his life that led him to that. And then if Max gets to the island, what would the wild things be like? And I started to try and just go inside the book as opposed to thinking of stuff I'd put on top of the book. And in thinking about who the wild things were, and when Max shows up and meets them or interacts with them, what would they be like? And I started to imagine them talking less like us and sounding like us. And that seemed really funny, like a funny idea to see these giant wild things with giant heads and giant eyes then speak, you know, like us, and not in like monster voices, but, you know, but then that didn't seem like enough of an idea for a movie. That was like a funny idea, but not like an idea for a movie. You know, whereas I kept thinking more about who they'd be, I started to think of them as wild emotions, and that idea seemed like a big one, like in terms of something that can seem, you know, can seem scary, like out of control emotions. I mean, it seems scary as a kid, and it can even still seem scary, and, you know, and out of control emotions in yourself or the people you're close to, and like how to navigate those. And as a kid, that's seems like a big idea. And so, you know, that was the way in, and it was sort of like that was the key. And as soon as I had that idea, it seemed like it was like a little riddle that had always been there for me in some way, that the wild things were wild emotions. And and that was, you know, and I called Maurice and said, I think I'd like to do this, and talked to him about it. And he was really encouraging of me. He never said if that was the right or wrong thing. And even when I was nervous of like, well, and this book means so much to so many people, I was nervous, you know, that my idea was just sort of what the book meant to me. Maurice was very encouraging. He was like almost belligerent in his, like, you know, his encouragement, and like basically said, you can't care what anybody else thinks. You just got to make something that's personal to you, and that was like his assignment to me.
One of the most famous things, obviously, about the book, Where the Wild Things Are the wild things themselves, the the monsters that Maurice Sendak created, which are, you know, a little scary but also kind of adorable. and they have all these like human elements. Like one of them seems to be almost wearing like a striped T-shirt, and a couple of them have actual feet instead of, you know, clawed hooves. And what was it like for you to have to figure out how to adapt these two-dimensional creatures? Well, I guess a movie's two-dimensional too, but I mean, they're just drawn on the page. How did you decide whether you wanted to go animation or, you know, live action or some combination of the two?
I mean, I guess the initial idea of doing it live action with, you know, building the creatures and shooting them for real with a, you know, with a real little kid on a real location was just a, you know, I don't think I analyzed it that much. It just, that's what felt right. And then as I started, as David Eggers and I started writing together, we started to talk about why that was important. And I think we realized, or I realized, that that decision was sort of, you know, important to taking the character seriously and taking his, you know, this is his world. And, you know, I think when I read the book and I imagined being Max, I didn't imagine being Max in like some animated version. I would imagine, you know, in the same way, like when you play war with your friends as a kid, you're playing war and it's totally real to you. And I think just taking, it was another extension of taking Max seriously, is just like, put him in this situation and it's for real, and you're not making like a movie version of it. We wanted a real kid, not a movie kid, in a real family situation. And by extension, you know, taking his imagination seriously and making him, allowing him to go to a real place with these creatures that are there in front of him, that can push him, hug him and pat him on the head, and with their claws sort of swiping close to his face, and there's just the physicality of it and the naturalism, and would add a visceral realism and also add a danger to it. It would have a more presence that would be dangerous.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Spike Jonze, and he co-wrote and directed the new movie adaptation of the Maurice Sendak children's classic, Where the Wild Things Are. He also directed the movie's adaptation, and being John Malkovich, and a whole lot of rock videos. The actor who plays Max, the actor's name is Max Records. How did you find him? Did you do a big, like, standard audition for children?
Yeah, we did. We did probably for about a year. We did casting in all the big cities around the country, and we found all, you know, amazing kids. Like some kids that we were really close to casting, actually. But we realized what we'd written, basically the role we'd written for Max in the movie, was a really complicated, challenging role, and the level of performance that we were looking for and the range of performance we were looking for, we started to realize like we're looking for like an 8-year-old Sean Penn or Daniel Day-Lewis, that, like, you know, just that you could hold on his face and that a lot is unspoken and you can see what he's thinking and feeling, and that at times he can be reckless and free and guileless and gleeful, and at times he can be internal and introspective, and we were looking for a lot. Eventually what happened was we started getting down to the wire and hadn't found our, you know, found Max yet. So we sort of came up with another plan. Instead of going through the traditional casting agents in all these big cities, we started to think maybe we should be looking for, if we're looking for a really interesting kid, maybe we need to look in areas that are more, have more creative artistic communities. And so we got friends of ours, like we got a good friend of ours who's a graphic designer in Athens, Georgia, or another friend in Amherst, Massachusetts, or a friend of ours, Lance Bangs, a documentarian in Portland, Oregon, who ultimately found Max in Portland. And we got those people to go out and just start putting kids on tape. And Lance Bangs found Max, and he had never acted before, but, you know, on the tape, it was just clear that there's something really special about him and beautiful and soulful.
Let me stop you a second. What did he film him doing if he'd never acted before? What was the tape like?
The tape, I think the initial tape was reading the scenes a couple times. It wasn't like a real in-depth audition. It was reading a couple scenes and then just having him run around. And I think he had him like take a plastic sword and sneak out into the backyard and attack his parents. And then he sent it to me, and there's just something sparkling about him. But it wasn't clear if he could act or not. And so then Catherine Keener, who plays the mom in the movie, but also she's a good friend of mine, and because I've worked with her so closely on my previous movies, I sort of sucked her into the movie in terms of in all different ways. And at first she was helping me like read with kids. The two of us would go in and sort of tag team and audition with kids. And so anyway, Keener was up in Oregon at the time shooting Into the Wild, Sean Penn's movie, and Lance Bangs brought Max over to Astoria where they're shooting, and on a day off, Keener auditioned with him and sort of dug deeper into some of the scenes and sent the tape to me, and that was when it was clear that he could act, and not in like a movie kid way, but like touching, you know, going there, and it was just clear that he was the person that I could make this movie with. And you know, he carries the movie. He's the heart of the movie, and you know, he's in every scene in the movie. The whole movie's told from his point of view. You know, these silent reaction shots on him that sort of guide us through the movie and tell us what he's thinking and feeling.
I think the color palette of your movie is kind of different than the book, Where the Wild Things Are. The book has a lot of kind of pastel colors. I mean, they're like light shades of like slightly washed out blues and greens and yellows and pinks. And your movie tends more toward like sepia tone type of colors. And I'm wondering why you made that choice.
I don't know. I guess I never analyzed a difference in color palette. I think what you know, there's a couple things with the book that we were trying to maintain. One, which is the graphic quality of the book and the scale. Those are things that we tried to translate into our approach, which was this, you know, photoreal, naturalistic approach. And it turned out to be a lot harder to do than we thought because, you know, I guess initially we were like went and looked at jungles, and both KK, our production designer, and I, we both sort of realized that jungles are really, you know, lack depth. They sort of just turn to mush, and it seems like a really limited way to shoot the movie. There's just so much undergrowth, and they're kind of visually boring. We needed to find nature that was more graphic, and one of the first discoveries KK found was a burnt-out forest, a forest that had a fire in it about 6 months earlier, and so all the undergrowth was gone. All the trees were charred black. The ground was charred black. And it became this sort of this canvas, basically, for KK to art direct nature in, and that became sort of the touchstone for what KK ended up doing. KK Barrett, our production designer, which was art directing nature. So we had this photoreal, naturalistic setting that then he can go and create the sort of graphic quality that's in the book. And so he, you know, in this forest, for example, he went in and sort of art directed the ground cover that would like a lighter leaves that would give contrast to the trees, and then went in and placed these little saplings, you know, throughout the forest. You know, it was just throughout all the locations, trying to sort of, you know, that became KK's job, is to art direct nature and create the look of the film.
So can you describe a little bit more what it was like to create The Wild Things for the movie with actual actors in costumes, but how did you get the faces of these monsters to move like they were alive?
You know, we edited the movie for almost a year and a half, and like we really were adamant that this, we never were going to let this be a visual effects movie where like the visual effects were driving the process. And so we always just considered a character movie, and we shot it in that way and we edited it in that way. And I think traditionally on visual effects movies, as you're editing, you're locking sequences and giving those to the visual effects department to start to work on. And on this movie, we didn't do that. So it made the process almost twice as long because post-production normally is overlapping, and ours wasn't. Once we finished editing and we locked a picture last year, then we started the visual effects process, which was creating the facial performances of the wild things you know, we had all the videotapes of the actors from the voice shoot when we'd shot them initially, and so it was a combination of referring back to those and seeing, you know, when that applied or didn't apply, and just going in and sort of meticulously frame by frame animating these performances. And and what we were looking for was really internal, subtle performances. And my dream was that when you'd put the camera on a Wild Thing, it would be the same as putting the camera on Meryl Streep or Nicolas Cage or James Gandolfini. You'd be able to just sit there, have the camera rest on their face as they're listening, or not even talking, just listening. You'd see what was going through their head and what they were feeling. And
but when you were actually directing the actors who were in the costumes, what were you looking at? Their real faces? Because the animation kind of happened afterwards.
It was basically we made the movie three times. Well, we made it a lot more than that, but in terms of the Wild Things, we made the movie three times. We made it once with the voice actors, once on location with the suit actors, where we're focusing on the movement of the body and what's being communicated by, you know, just the most subtlest head tilt. And then we made it a third time when we did the faces in post-production. And, you know, so the creation of the Wild Things are basically three disparate elements and trying to make them all work together to create one fluid performance.
Now, did you hold auditions for the suit actors, for the actors who were going to be in costumes as these, you know, animals or monsters, and we're never going to see their faces because their faces are going to be animated? But they still have to move in the spirit of the character, and their moves have to be big because they're big creatures.
Their moves had to be big, but they had to be subtle. I think one of the things that happens sometimes in puppeteering and animation, which works for, you know, a certain type of story but wasn't appropriate for this, is the performance become very broad and indicated, and you know, the way, you know, just the way somebody animates a character, sometimes their entire body is saying a word, and it's not often how we speak. And I thought it was exciting to try and take these giant creatures and have them perform and behave and think and feel and emote more like us, and that seemed interesting and exciting and strange. And the suit actors we cast, we did a whole broad casting call for people that had been in suits and hadn't been in suits, and we were basically looking for people. It was like casting actor who is right for the part, who has the essence of that character that can perform that. And, you know, that combined with who can actually survive inside that suit for, you know, 4 months on location, and because it physically was really challenging for those guys. And so we were looking for the demeanor of somebody who wasn't going to, like, have a panic attack in there or stress out. And we were looking for, you know, for very even level people, but also looking for people with the judgment that I trust. And in the end, we cast people that had never been in suits before, because those were the actors that I found whose judgment I trusted the most for that part.
Are there actors who are professional suit actors who almost always perform in suits?
Yeah, they are. They're like, you know.
What kind of roles do they get? How many roles are there?
I mean, I guess there's a lot, you know, that whether it's like on children's shows or they playing gorillas or, you know, whatever it might be, bears, telephones, talking telephones for TV commercials.
Were you with Maurice Sendak the first time he saw your movie version of his book?
Yeah.
Were you watching his face instead of the movie?
I can't remember if, I mean, I think I was probably trying to, I think Maurice was as nervous as we were, but I don't know, there's something early on that gave me, that I can't remember what it was, but I maybe it was a laugh early on or something that I could just tell he was in the movie and feeling it. And, and when the lights came up, you know, he gave me a big hug and was really proud of me and proud of the movie. And, you know, above and beyond anything, that's the approval that I value the most.
Spike Jonze, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Spike Jonze directed and co-wrote the new movie adaptation of Maurice Sendak's classic children's book, Where the Wild Things Are. The big news in the world of books last week was that German writer Herta Mueller won the Nobel Prize. The big news in the world of books this week is that the fourth novel in Jeff Kinney's wildly best-selling Diary of a Wimpy Kid series for preteens has just hit bookstores, and it's the number one bestseller on Amazon.com. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says it was hard to decide which milestone to focus on, but comedy ultimately triumphed.
Our local independent bookstore opened extra early on the morning of October 12th to sell copies of the insanely anticipated latest book in Jeff Kinney's Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, this one entitled Dog Days. The last time I remember that bookstore being overrun with hordes of kids yelping for a book was when the final Harry Potter novel came out. It was midnight when the Potter boxes were broken open and the kids were dressed as macabre creatures from Hogwarts. The atmosphere surrounding the arrival of Kinney's latest book was appropriately sprightlier. The bookstore opened at dawn, after all, and distributed donuts. Like the Potter series, Kinney's books are aimed at a middle school audience, but translate well to older readers. Unlike the Potter series, Kinney's books are funny, the kind of funny where you have to stop reading every so often because you're laughing so hard, tears and snot are running down your face, and you feel like maybe you'll even throw up. How's that for an erudite critical endorsement? I started reading Kinney at the command of my 11-year-old daughter. One of the things she hates most in the world is when adults loom over her and ask, "So, are you a big reader like your mother?" She's not. She's much more socially well-adjusted than I am and doesn't seek out quiet corners where she can seal herself off with a book, far from the madding crowd. She soured on the Potter saga about halfway through when the storylines got grislier. Kinney, however, is just her ticket. Not only is his series hero, Greg Heffley, a middle school everyman, forever waiting for his growth spurt as he's surrounded by gorilla classmates who need to shave twice a day, but the books themselves are stories in cartoon form, otherwise known as graphic novels. Because the conceit of the series is that the books themselves are journals that Greg is keeping, the cartoons here are strictly stick figure. But what a range of middle school misery Kinney wrings out of a few lines. The bend of Greg's back under a jumbotron-sized book bag, the quaking of his scrawny body as he's perched on the edge of the freezing school pool, waiting for the swim meet whistle to blow and seal his doom. The cartoons don't merely illustrate the story, they advance it and split it off into 100 digressive tributaries, working like the footnotes in Eliot's Wasteland. Admittedly, maybe I'm reaching for a high art analogy because I'm still a little uncomfortable about my kid preferring to read what amounts to a hardcover comic book series over, say, Little Women. But Kinney has anticipated this kind of helicopter parent squeamishness. In Dog Days, Greg Heffley's relentlessly chirpy mom starts a summer reading club. At the first meeting, the other boys report on the books they've brought, among them Sudoku Insanity and Extreme Pop-Up Sharks. Greg's mom says these books aren't real literature and insists that the club is going to have to start with the classics. Greg says that he's not really sure what makes a book a classic, but he thinks it has to be at least 50 years old and some person or animal has to die at the end. He says these are the type of books teachers are always pushing us to read at school, and that if you read a classic in your free time, the teachers reward you with a sticker of a hamburger or something like that. Clearly, Kinney has an ear and eye for the middle school milieu. For adult readers, he vividly brings back the oceanic feeling of helplessness that swamps most of us at that age when you're not in control of your weirdly changing body or, much of the time, even what you're allowed to eat or read. Last spring, in the delirious company of my daughter and two of her middle school guy friends, I heard Jeff Kinney speak at the University of Maryland. It was one of the best author talks I've ever attended. Kinney had the whole cavernous auditorium, adults, kids, roaring with laughter. Kinney gets the powerlessness of late childhood. In his appearance that day and throughout his ongoing series, he's made all the wimpy kids out there know that they're in good company.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days by Jeff Kinney. I'm Terry Gross.